Many of Saddam's crimes, however, are extremely well documented.
Let's see the archives.
Okay.
In the archives of a new museum being set up in Baghdad, the victims beg for mercy. Saddam's brother orders them beaten unconscious. Another victim is more swiftly dispatched, an explosive placed in his shirt pocket. In short, there's no question about the shocking brutality of Saddam Hussein's regime. But will the special tribunal bring to justice all those most responsible, not just Iraqis, but all those most responsible for the horrors of the era of Saddam? That's what millions of Iraqis want to know.
I want to know what happened between the U.S. government and the Iraqi government, and what role the U.S. government had played in supporting Saddam Hussein. What deals have been made? I'm not after lynching Saddam. Saddam is gone. I want to know the truth. We owe it to the history, and we owe it to ourselves and to our families and the dead people, all the millions that have been killed.
What is that truth? What complicity did the United States and its Western allies have with crimes committed during the reign of Saddam? Saddam will be charged with launching a bloody war of aggression against Iran in 1979. But last July, Saddam rejects all guilt. For him, it was nothing more than a normal event. That normal event lasted for 8 terrible years and resulted in the deaths of a million people. And there are those who charge that, from the start, it was the United States and its allies who supported that war against Iran and its feared fundamentalist leader, Ayatollah Khomeini. Eric Rouleau is a former French ambassador to the Middle East.
Khomeini frightened everyone in the West. French interests were severely hit at the time. And it goes without saying that all action against Iran would be welcome in Washington. There's no doubt that Saddam Hussein was assured of having the support of the West, which he immediately obtained.
In fact, it's alleged that Saddam received a go-ahead for that attack from the United States. This charge is bolstered by a confidential memo written in 1982 to Ronald Reagan from Alexander Haig, his Secretary of State. Haig wrote that, using the Saudis as go-betweens, President Carter gave the Iraqis a green light to launch the war against Iran. Further, the U.S. may actually have helped the Iraqis plan their attack against Iran. It was in this Parisian hotel that the secret meeting supposedly took place. This, according to Abu Hossam Banisadr, the president of Iran at that time. His spies bought him a copy of that plan.
According to this plan, it was in Paris, between the Americans, the Israelis, and the Iraqis, that the plan was prepared to attack Iran in order to smash, if you wish, the force of the Iranian revolution.
But couldn't it have been a counterfeit document, a false plan?
The war was made exactly according to the plan. Fortunately, we bought it before the war because it was that plan that saved Iran.
I believe that to be accurate.
Why?
Because I had officials that said that it was our work.
The battle plan?
Well, we had access to it, at least.
At the time, investigative reporter Richard Sale had close ties with U.S. intelligence sources. The Americans, he says, were also feeding Saddam trumped-up information about Iran.
I was in contact with a whole range of U.S. officials, and we were clearly stuffing Saddam's head with nonsense to make conditions look better than they were.
To encourage him to go into Iran.
To encourage him to go in. Yeah, it's going to be a breeze.
In fact, the Iranian resistance was much stronger than Saddam had expected. But over the following years, countries of the West and East fed and financed Saddam's military machine.
At that time, the black devil was Iran. Therefore, anyone who fought Iran was welcome for the West.
Roland Dumas was French Minister of Foreign Affairs. The war, he says, was also enthusiastically supported by the arms merchants.
All those who were moved by economic interest. Therefore, it was our military, it was our arms industry.
Pierre Marion headed France's Secret Service in 1981. Dassault Aviation, he says, made billions of dollars selling Saddam their most sophisticated fighter, the Mirage.
Dassault was the one that most profited from the war, the one that pushed the most. You have to see the pressure that was put on French leaders by the different internal powers in France, particularly Dassault, which had extremely important and forceful means of pressure.
It may be that France not only supplied their best fighter planes to Saddam, but also their pilots.
The French began to fly Air Force missions for him. I mean,
what?
The French sold him Mirage fighters.
Right.
They were on contract to, you know, supposedly to maintain the plane. There was some devious arrangement like that, but they were flying missions. The agency told me first, the Pentagon confirmed it.
And the French never denied it?
No.
With such massive support from the West and his Arab neighbors, Saddam battled on. It became the bloodiest conflict of the past quarter century. It turns out that the United States and its allies knew all about Saddam's chemical weapons from the very beginning. In 1983, for instance, Donald Rumsfeld, now Secretary of Defense, then a private business executive, is given a mission by President Ronald Reagan.
I'm pleased to announce today the appointment of Donald Rumsfeld as my special representative for the Middle East. I can't.
One of his assignments, to bolster U.S. ties with Saddam. 20 years later, an interviewer shows a tape of that embarrassing hand clasp to Donald Rumsfeld.
Where did you get this video? From the Iraqi television,
I see.
I see. Isn't that interesting? There I am.
Rumsfeld maintains that after that handshake, he gave a clear warning to Iraq's foreign minister.
In that visit, I cautioned him about the use of chemical weapons, as a matter of fact, and discussed a host of other things.
But that cautioning may have been lost among that host of other things. 4 months after Rumsfeld's visit, American journalist Joe Trento visited Iraq. He flew over a battlefield with his pilot, Mohammed.
And we flew very low over the battlefield and we started seeing bodies. But the bodies weren't injured. And there were body after body just laying in position. And I asked Mohammed, what happened? And Mohammed says, mustard gas.
Back in Baghdad, Trento told the top diplomats at the American embassy what he'd seen. They weren't surprised.
They knew exactly what Saddam was. They knew that he was engaging in the production of illegal poison gases like mustard gas, that the byproducts to make the gas was being brought in from Germany, and that the United States was well aware of how he was using it. It was quite clear that we were aware of it as Americans. We knew everything that was going on, and we took no action.
Though they knew Saddam was using mustard gas against the enemy, the United States also supplied him with satellite intelligence to locate Iranian troops. That aid suddenly increased in 1988 when Rick Francona, an Air Force captain, was dispatched to Baghdad. His mission? To provide precise Iranian targets to the Iraqi Air Force to destroy a threatened Iranian offensive.
What we were trying to do was blunt the Iranian ability to launch the offensive. We were very concerned that if that offensive kicked off, it would be in the end of the war in Iranian favor. And that's what we were trying to prevent.
But then Francona discovered that the Iraqis had started using even more deadly chemical weapons, nerve gas, against the Iranians. Francona informed his superiors in Washington. The response was immediate.
We were told to cease all of our cooperation with the Iraqis until people in Washington were able to sort this out. There were a series of almost daily meetings on how are we going to handle this, what do we do? Do we continue our relations with the Iraqis and ensure that the Iranians do not win this war, or do we let the Iraqis fight this on their own without any U.S. assistance, and they'll probably lose? So there are your options, neither one palatable. The decision was made that we would restart our relationship with the Iraqis. We went back to Baghdad.
And continued?
Exactly. Continued on as before.
The most notorious of Saddam's crimes was the massacre at Halabja, a Kurdish village where more than 5,000 civilians were wiped out by chemical weapons in 1988. That was the crime repeatedly cited by George W. Bush as partial justification for invading Iraq in 2003.
Whole families died while trying to flee clouds of nerve and mustard agents descending from the sky. The chemical attack on Halabja provided a glimpse of the crimes Saddam Hussein is willing to commit.
At his arraignment in Baghdad, Saddam replied, "I've heard talk about it, but I have no direct knowledge." Ironically, in 1988, the reaction of many Western leaders to news of Halabja was equally vague. Instead of denouncing it, the United States first blamed Iran, anything to avoid condemning Saddam Hussein.
France and the United States acted the same way. They virtually ignored the massacre. They were squashing it. No one wanted to talk about that.
Jean-Pierre Chevènement.
I think that to judge that affair in context, it's always necessary to come back to the decisive importance of that region from the point of view of supplying petroleum to the world. Who controls that region controls the financial balance of the world. Therefore, it's an absolutely decisive question. And one never has a choice between the good and the bad. One has a choice between the bad and the less bad. And taking account that this region is like a cauldron of violence, you have the choice between what is horrible and what is terrible.
Between Iran and Iraq, the government of Ronald Reagan had long ago made its choice. Peter Galbraith, then a key Senate staffer, attempted in vain to put Kurdish leaders with evidence about the Halabja massacre in touch with the Department of State.
The U.S. refused to see the Kurdish leaders. There was a ban on contacts with them, as indeed there was became a ban on contacts with other members of the Iraqi opposition.
Because?
Because nobody wanted to upset Saddam Hussein. And if Kurds getting gassed was something that would cause troubles, neither the Reagan nor the Bush administration wanted to hear a word about it. And this position of opposing the sanctions legislation was coordinated by the National Security Advisor, who was Colin Powell.
Colin Powell, who, of course, later as Secretary of State, went before the UN Security Council and used Saddam's supposed weapons of mass destruction as justification for invading Iraq. But the biggest irony in all this, if the special tribunal in Baghdad is seriously looking for accomplices to Saddam's chemical weapon massacres, they should be looking at Western companies.
We've been tracking transfers of things useful for making weapons of mass destruction for a long time.
Gary Mulholland is an expert on international arms sales.
Our estimation is that Germany supplied far more than anybody else to Iraq's chemical weapon program, but the French certainly were important suppliers. A company named Protec was the main French supplier, according to our records, and it supplied a multi-million dollar chemical factory to Iraq, together with some German firms.
Did they have to know about what they were doing, or couldn't they have been quite innocent?
They had to know. Or at least they had to have very strong suspicions.
In Paris, we contacted Protec, the company which equipped a chemical plant north of Baghdad in 1987.
Can you let me talk to some official of the company to whom I can ask that question directly?
No.
Why?
Because in fact they don't want to speak about that, very simply.
Nobody wants to talk about that?
No, I don't think so, no.
Because this subject is embarrassing for the company?
In a way, yes.
The defense offered by Protect and some German companies at the time was that they had sold only fertilizer to Iraq. But the truth about such matters for Protect and hundreds of other Western companies could probably be found among the thousands of files that UN inspectors seized in Iraq during the many years they were there. Today, however, those files are secret, locked up in the headquarters of the United Nations in New York. Have you talked with the UN people about this?
Sure.
And what do they tell you?
It's confidential.
But are they looking at it themselves, or their own inspectors examining this?
Right now, the UN isn't busy inspecting anything in Iraq. My impression is that this is just a large stack of information that the UN is sitting on for no good reason.
Or maybe for very good reason.
Well, unless the UN wants to protect the companies.
Overnight, Saddam's offensive shatters the relations between the United States and their former ally. The leader, who George Bush had been assiduously courting, was transformed into the most vicious of tyrants.
We're dealing with Hitler revisited, a totalitarianism and a brutality that is naked and unprecedented.
But, once again, there are those who accuse the United States of also being responsible for Saddam's attack on Kuwait. For when President Bush was warned early on that Saddam's troops were beginning to mobilize, he didn't react. He wanted to believe that Saddam was just bluffing. Some claim he was still making every effort to conciliate the Iraqi dictator, for he saw Iraq as an enormous potential market.
There was a real euphoria about Iraq as the next powerhouse in the region and a place with unlimited amounts of money that could become an important American partner.
And customer.
So, President Bush didn't send any stiff warning to Saddam. In fact, American diplomats made it seem as if the United States would not even react militarily. 8 days before the invasion, Saddam asked to meet with American Ambassador April Glaspie. She assured him that the United States would take no position in the event of any border conflict between Iraq and Kuwait. She left, announcing she was going on vacation.
Saddam Hussein feels completely reassured. There you have an ambassadress who leaves for vacation the 26th or the 27th of July, while he had fixed the date for the invasion, August 1st. And particularly that declaration, we won't get mixed up in anything.
2 days later, what Glaspie said was repeated in public hearings by a much higher U.S. official, Tom Kelly, Assistant Secretary of State. Congressman Lee Hamilton repeatedly asked Kelly how the United States would respond if Saddam attacked Kuwait.
I recall asking him about treaty commitments, and the secretary said there were no treaty commitments involved here.
So if you were Saddam Hussein listening to that, what would your...
We did not draw, it seems to me, a firm line in the sand. We did not convey strongly and clearly that we would react militarily if he went across that border.
A few days later, Saddam invaded Kuwait. Later, when the United States was mobilizing hundreds of thousands of soldiers, another American congressman, Tom Lantos, delivered an even more devastating rebuke to Tom Kelly and the U.S. government for having so long refused to recognize the true nature of Saddam.
This obsequious treatment of him by a large variety of high-ranking officials encouraged him to take this action. And there is no way of escaping that responsibility.
As the U.S. and its coalition allies prepared to do battle against Saddam, they confronted another awful irony. In many ways, they were taking on an enemy they and their arms dealers had done so much to create. And that brought some peculiar problems. For years, for instance, as part of the deal to sell Mirage fighter planes to Saddam, France also agreed to train Saddam's pilots in France.
When the war broke out with Iraq over Kuwait, I realized that there were still pilots who were being trained in France on the planes that we had sold them, which meant that suddenly we found ourselves in a state of war with Iraq, and we had Iraqi pilots in France.
But even more embarrassing for the French, their crack French fighter pilots were unable to show off their sophisticated Mirage in the fight against Saddam. Why? Because they were exactly the same planes they'd sold to the Iraqis.
Although the French were fairly precluded from participating in a lot of the offensive air campaign, we were very concerned that our pilots would not be able to distinguish between a French-operated Mirage and an Iraqi-operated Mirage, so we were worried about fratricide.
An even bigger quandary for the U.S. and its allies was the extremely effective defense radar system that the French firm Thompson had sold to Saddam for hundreds of millions of dollars. It incorporated all the newest technologies.
The French were able to build a system that integrated all of this into a coordinated air defense system that was quite sophisticated. I mean, it was a very, very difficult system to attack.
So what was done?
Well, because the French were part of the coalition, they were able to provide us a lot of information on the system, where the critical nodes were, and we were able to attack it quite successfully.
So the French in the end gave...
The French in the end took down their own system, basically.
Of course, the amount of aid the Americans had given Saddam over the years would also present some curious problems, some that continue to this day. For instance, we found that some of Saddam's elite forces were brought to the United States in the 80s to be given specialized training by the famed American Green Berets.
We were training through the Green Berets. We were training counterinsurgency training because we were afraid that if Iran overwhelmed Saddam's army, that the units might have to go underground and operate underground. And so they received training in being able to operate as guerrillas themselves on their home turf. You can imagine now, as we look back on that effort to train them, the consequences were our own troops now facing the Iraqis who got that training from the United States.
In 1991, with the U.S. and its allies now out to destroy the military machine they'd done so much to create, the Gulf War became a showcase of the most sophisticated Western technology, a huge, bloody video game.
I see people running around. There you go.
Saddam's forces are driven out of Kuwait, but Saddam's defeat only sets the stage for an even more ghastly tragedy. These mass graves are evidence of the most massive atrocity of which Saddam is accused, the slaughter of 300,000 Shiites, their remains only now being uncovered. They rose up against the dictator in 1991 after Saddam's defeat in Kuwait and were horrifically repressed. A crime denounced around the globe. But once again, the United States and its allies were complicit in those killings.
The United States had total responsibility for those uprisings. By militarily smashing Saddam Hussein, it created the possibility for the uprisings. And second, the first President Bush on the 15th of February twice called for the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam Hussein.
That call came with the United States still battling Iraqi forces.
The world will not allow.
President Bush suggested a way to end the conflict, a massive popular revolt.
There's another way for the bloodshed to stop, and that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands, to force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside.
The president's call was repeatedly broadcast all over Iraq.
The same message over and over again about, rise up. It's your time to do that. It's your duty to get rid of Saddam and his regime.
Zainab is a Shiite from the southern city of Karbala, one of thousands who joined the uprising.
I felt this is my fight. I was only 20 years old, coming out of high school, and there is no hope, there is no future inside Iraq. So it was, for me, it was, I have to fight for my freedom.
The uprising was spontaneous, unplanned, and it swept across southern Iraq like wildfire. Many of Saddam's soldiers joined the revolt.
It was a great victory. We felt just so great. There was a hope that they will get rid of Saddam, it will be over, and they will build a new Iraq.
Meanwhile, in the north of Iraq, the country's Kurds also launched an uprising.
In a few weeks, it had taken over all of Kurdistan. And so there was this enormous sense of euphoria. For the first time, the Kurds were controlling their own destiny.
But tragedy was building. Once the U.S. had expelled Saddam from Kuwait, it turned out that George Bush, despite his calls for an uprising, had no serious plans for Iraq at all.
As a result,
at the time, Thomas Pickering was high up in the U.S. government, ambassador to the United Nations.
We had wonderfully prepared combat activities, and we had absolutely no idea about what to do in a post-combat phase.
And there was no policy?
No policy, real settled interests, no examination of what we should do, no examination of how we should deal with the future, except that we didn't want to go to Baghdad.
Deploying hundreds of thousands of troops without any idea what you're going to do?
Yep. Fairly convincingly so.
How could that have happened?
Well, it happened 13 years later. Why ask the question about 1991?
Same thing now.
Yeah.
So back in 1991, when the peace treaty was signed, the Americans forbid the Iraqis from flying their planes, but allowed them to keep using their helicopters. Helicopters which the Iraqis then used with deadly effect against the uprising.
We wanted the freedom. 3/4 of the cities are liberated and not under the control of Saddam. He's in his weakest point. We need to be liberated and we need help.
What help?
The help that America promised to give to Iraqis.
When did they promise to give help?
Well, that was through the radio and what we heard in the radio.
And that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein to step aside.
If you listen to what Bush said, he never explicitly said, we will give you help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what was understood among the people.
How do you explain, then, these calls for an uprising on the part of the United States?
All of the efforts to debilitate Saddam and to create problems for him in order to remove him from Kuwait were justified.
Even though the U.S. couldn't follow up afterwards to help these people who rose up?
In war and love, all's fair.
Having called for the uprising, the Bush administration then decided it didn't want it to succeed.
We are not in the process now of assisting through provisioning arms to these groups that are in uprising against the current government. We don't want to see a power vacuum develop in Iraq. We want to see the territorial integrity of Iraq preserved. So do all of the other coalition partners.
Every president I have known has described the U.S. interests in the Gulf as a vital interest. Presidents do not use the word vital casually. Vital means vital. And it means that if we don't have access to that oil, it affects the vital interests of the United States. We're in trouble immediately.
That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. There's no question about it.
The Americans wanted that Saddam Hussein be replaced, but by them, in order to control the country. What good is it to have made a war if you leave the power with people that you don't know?
To find an American witness to the human result of that realpolitik, we went to southern Arizona and spoke with Rocky Gonzalez, a veteran of U.S. Special Forces. In 1991, he was stationed in southern Iraq.
People started showing up at our perimeter with chemical burns. Burns on their face, their hands, places where our skin was exposed. They were coming to us in streams, saying that we were fighting the Iraqi military and the Ba'ath Party, and they sprayed us with chemicals.
And these people, what did they want?
They wanted aid. They wanted to be treated. They wanted to be protected. And some of the individuals who were armed wanted us to give them weapons and ammunition so they could go fight.
What did you ask of to the Americans?
We asked them for military help and food because we had neither arms nor food nor water. Their reply was to give nothing. They said it was the orders that they had received from the Pentagon.
We were under orders not to assist or to aid in any way, so we could not.
Had they been given any encouragement from the U.S.?
There were pamphlets that were dropped by the psychological operation units, and those leaflets told them to rise up and fight the regime and free themselves. One individual carried it, and he was waving it at us.
One of the insurgents was from the United States, from Detroit.
The individual who approached me had a Detroit driver's license, had a Social Security card. He made very strong requests, and he says, I'm an American citizen. We need your help. And I said, right now, at this point in time, President Bush said the war is over. We cannot give you any assistance.
But the U.S. weren't just neutral bystanders. We found that in some cases, the Americans actually helped stifle the uprising. Survivors recounted how American troops prevented some insurgents from marching on Baghdad.
The American helicopters landed on the road to block our way, and they stopped us from continuing. One of the American soldiers threatened to kill us if we did not turn back.
The U.S. also destroyed huge stocks of captured Iraqi weapons, supposedly to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Iraqi army. In fact, they could have been a vital help to the uprising.
Yes, we had a stockpile of weapons. We destroyed them on a regular basis. And I'm sure that they wanted those weapons. I mean, they've asked us for weapons.
I saw that with my own eyes. At Nasiriyah, they blew up an enormous stockpile of arms. If we had been able to get hold of it, the whole course of history would have changed in favor of the uprising, because Saddam had nothing left at that moment.
And so, as the U.S. and its allies stood by, the horrific slaughter began. Instead of trying to cover it up, Saddam actually ordered the images to be broadcast by Iraqi television, an object lesson to anyone who would challenge his rule.
In every corner you see it. People are being killed and, you know, grabbed, women are being raped and all of these things. This was awful. Many people been taken to the desert and been executed. They've been begging the soldiers, you know. And many of my friends and my classmates, just many of them died, many of them
died. They killed people in groups, everyone. They killed the children, the women, the innocents. I was thrown into a mass grave and survived, a miracle. I was tortured. I lost three brothers. The Ba'ath Party members beat them and buried them alive.
We knew it had to be horrendous.
And that you left.
Soldiers following orders. As a human being, it was very gut-wrenching for me. I wanted to assist them any way I could. And the Iraqis that I was in touch with on a daily basis, a lot of them loved Americans and thanked us for being there. As a human being, I wanted to help. But as a soldier, I had my orders.
As the Shiites were being wiped out in the south, Saddam's troops turned north to destroy the Kurdish rebellion. Peter Galbraith was there with the Kurds.
There were tens of thousands of people suddenly moving out of their homes. Nobody was going to wait around and see what Saddam was going to do, all heading for the mountains. A sense of disbelief and betrayal about the first President Bush. Here was the sea of humanity. I mean, 2 million people moving to the mountains. And, of course, thousands ended up dying in really tough conditions. And this was something where my country was completely responsible.
At the time, the leader of the Allies, President George Bush, was on vacation, resisting any involvement.
I do not want to push American forces beyond our mandate. And of course, I feel a frustration and a sense of grief for the innocents that are being killed brutally. But we are not there to intervene.
What forced George Bush to turn around was television. Images like this broadcast around the world. President Bush finally declared a no-fly zone to protect the Kurds in northern Iraq and ordered Saddam to immediately cease his attacks. Saddam complied. But in the south, where there was no television coverage, the massacre of the Shiites continued. But there are other horrifying images from Iraq, from the country's devastated health system. This was not the work of Saddam, at least not directly. It was the product of another weapon of mass destruction. The sanctions imposed on Iraq by the United Nations Security Council after Saddam invaded Kuwait. Those sanctions cut all trade between Iraq and the rest of the world and lasted for 12 terrible years.
This sanctions program was devastating in its impact, probably responsible for the loss of 500,000 to over a million Iraqis, particularly children, but also adults.
Dennis Holliday was the UN's humanitarian coordinator in Iraq until he resigned in 1998.
I did not want to be a party to that program of what effectively is genocide.
What do you mean genocide?
Well, if you look at the definition of genocide, it requires intent and it requires the destruction of a culture, of an ethnic group, or of a nation of people. And the Council was well aware of the impact of these sanctions. They knew of the death rates. Despite that information, they continued the program. Now, the result of that was then you had children falling ill, going to hospital, and not getting proper medical care for lack of medicines, sophisticated drugs. Even then the equipment for surgery and other essentials ran out after a year or two in the early 90s.
Hans von Sponeck took over from Holliday until the year 2000, when he also resigned in protest.
It was a terribly sad picture to see that lack of medicines, of medicines that one can buy even without prescription, like, for example, rehydration fluids. People were dying in Iraqi hospitals.
Did you ever talk to American officials also on the impact of the sanctions?
Naturally. The reaction varied from listening to ridiculing. When I, for example, in the State Department in Washington referred to the plight of the hospitals, particularly children's hospital, the response from the group in the State Department was, you went to the propaganda hospital.
At the beginning, in 1990, the object of the UN sanctions was to oblige Saddam to withdraw from Kuwait.
The idea of the sanctions was to do what?
The idea of the sanctions was to see whether, in the words of the UN Charter, we could use measures short of war to force an end to the aggression.
And?
Didn't work.
Okay. But the sanctions remained.
Sanctions remained after the war because they were continued after the war. Because after the war, there were a large number of burdens that we put on Saddam, which we wanted him to perform on, and the sanctions were one of the major forms of leverage to get him to try to perform.
But that didn't work either.
Didn't work as well as we'd hoped.
It was Washington and London who had final say on the embargo, and they blocked many vital medical supplies. The pretext? They could conceivably be used for military purposes.
It was a tool to destroy Iraq in the absence of any other policy, to suppress Saddam Hussein and to suppress Iraq as a leading Arab state and its potential for leadership of the Arab world.
Key to that plan, according to Dennis Holliday, was the deliberate destruction of Iraq's water and electrical systems. They were prime targets for American bombs, and the result was no safe water to drink.
People resorted then to drinking from the Tigris and the Euphrates, and the outbreaks of typhoid, hepatitis, all the waterborne diseases were extraordinary and devastating.
Those deadly consequences may actually have been planned. In 1991, a secret Defense Department study, bluntly entitled Iraq's Water Treatment Vulnerabilities, foresaw the massive rise in death and disease that would result from the crippling of the country's water system. And as if they were following that study, over the next 12 years, the U.S. used the embargo to block the import of key parts needed to restore the system, many of them highlighted by the original Pentagon study.
The theory goes was that if you hurt the people of Iraq and kill their children, they will rise up in anger and overthrow this tyrant, quote unquote. But they didn't blame Saddam Hussein. They blamed the United States and the United Nations for the sanctions and the pain and the anguish that sanctions brought to their lives.
The embargo finally ended in 2003, but the collapse of Iraq's water system is still not repaired. The result, the very young, sick and dying, still fill the wards of the Children's Hospital in Baghdad.
Yeah, this one, this example, this is the six-month-old baby, female, girl, six-month-old, chronic diarrhea. Since the age of 2 months, the chlorinations of water supply, still there is a major problems. Water, not sterile water, so yani, causing the diarrhea. Diarrhea causes malnutrition, and malnutrition causing more susceptibility to get infectious diarrhea.
What is different since the end of the embargo?
Nothing has changed, nothing. We still don't have medicines. The suffering is still the same.
In Washington, most members of the U.S. Congress, Republican and Democrats, supported the sanctions.
I think the sanctions contained Saddam Hussein. I think the sanctions made it difficult, if not impossible, for Saddam Hussein to build up his military force. I think the sanctions were an effective policy.
The charge is that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died because of the sanctions.
I can't verify the figures, but I have to tell you that the reason why 100,000 or more of Iraqis died was the role that Saddam played in the actual carrying out of the programs under the sanctions.
That's partly true. Saddam and his friends are accused of having made off with hundreds of millions of dollars thanks to the sanctions. But the United States always knew about such charges. Despite that, they continued to impose the embargo.
Maintaining the sanctions, knowing they're working or working only partially, knowing the impact that they're having on the people of Iraq, why keep them in place?
Because there was no alternative program to have it done better.
In 1996, a reporter from CBS Television interviewed the American ambassadress to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, about the Iraqi children who were dying because of the sanctions. On the Internet, some pacifist sites copied some of the interview. Listen.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
This tells you the mentality of the U.S. administration.
She said afterwards that she regretted having said that.
Oh, come on. Regretted. She is sorry not for the killing of the 500,000 children. She's sorry she said it. She was thinking aloud.
Was it worth it?
I believe it was worth having the sanctions on because in the end, in a strange way, they may have helped to produce the mindset that got rid of the weapons of mass destruction that we can't find now.
So who's a bigger killer? The sanctions or Saddam? That's a question I want to ask. Well, okay, Saddam Hussein is atrocious, but the West is even worse by endorsing the sanctions. Because they killed more of our people than Saddam Hussein.
Saddam undoubtedly will receive the maximum penalty, he and his Iraqi accomplices. But what about the others, the non-Iraqis, Western businessmen, Western governments? Will they ever be brought before the court? In fact, the United States government was key in setting up the tribunal. One expert consulted early on by the Americans was Professor Sherif Bassiouni. The result, he says, is not what he expected.
All efforts are made to have a tribunal
whose judiciary is not going to be independent, but is going to be very strictly controlled. And by controlled, I mean the political manipulators of the tribunal have to make sure that the United States and other Western powers are not brought in cause. I think that the way the rules are going to be drafted are going to be to create almost total insulation for the U.S. and other major powers from any of these issues being raised. It makes it appear victor's vengeance, it makes it appear targeted, selective, unfair. So it's a subterfuge.
We took Bastioni's charge to Salem Chalabi in Baghdad. He's a nephew of America's one-time protege, Ahmad Chalabi, and was appointed to organize the special tribunal. He asked us not to show his face.
I am threatened now. I mean, somebody was just visiting me, a military person. He says, you are now, you know, have the most dangerous position in Iraq.
We asked Chalabi if all those most complicit in Saddam's massive crimes, if all of them will be obliged to face the special tribunal.
First of all, the statute of the tribunal makes it only, the only jurisdiction is for Iraqi citizens and residents of Iraq. So that's the statute, that's the, how the law was passed, okay? We're not here to try everybody in the world for what they did. Now, the whole purpose of this tribunal is accountability, and accountability for people who committed war crimes. It is not to try to write the history of the last 35 years. That's going to be left to other organizations, other things. The purpose of the tribunal is justice.
It was after that interview had ended that Salem Chalabi finally told us what he'd resisted saying while our cameras were running. If we had wanted to accuse non-Iraqis of complicity with the crimes of Saddam Hussein, it would have meant 5 years of negotiations with the Americans. That wasn't possible, he said, because we Iraqis want a rapid trial.
They don't want the truth to come out. That's why they don't let that happen. And this is why I want Saddam Hussein to be actually tried by independent court.
Why independent?
Because it's only through an independent court that we will know. I'm not interested in punishing or not punishing Saddam. I'm interested in knowing the truth. We have to make sure that we know what the story is.